It's morning in America. Do you know where your kidneys are? In a tough economy, what can you get for your organs on the open market? You think I'm kidding? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Wednesday, April 30th. Today, lots of news on the fragile economy. Senator Barack Obama divorces his former pastor, and China's getting more than it bargained for with the Olympics.
In other headlines, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is defending his decision to send a second aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf. He says it serves as a reminder to Iran of America's presence in the region, but nothing more.
I don't think we'll have two carriers there for a protracted period of time, so I don't see it as an escalation.
Secretary Gates said the deployment was planned a while ago. Senator Barack Obama says he's outraged and angry over the latest comments from his former pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Obama said yesterday Wright offers conspiracy theories and other ideas that go against what Obama stands for.
They do not portray accurately the perspective of the black church. They certainly don't portray accurately my values and beliefs.
The Democratic presidential candidate made his comments while campaigning in North Carolina. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton has picked up the endorsement of North Carolina Governor Mike Easley in advance of Tuesday's Democratic primary.
Explosions and gunfire woke up Kabul today. Afghan security forces have been fighting a group of armed men and have sealed off part of the city. No reports yet if the gunfight is with Taliban insurgents or a criminal gang. It's a critical day for Pakistan's new Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif. Today's the deadline for reinstating senior judges sacked by President Pervez Musharraf last year. Sharif is warning that dire consequences for democracy in Pakistan if the judges are not restored.
One casualty of the faltering economy appears to be summer vacation. The latest consumer confidence survey says the number of people planning to take a vacation in the next 6 months is at its lowest point in 30 years. The market is watching the economy today big time. The first quarter GDP report will be released this morning with more clues about whether we're expanding or contracting. This afternoon, the Fed is likely to announce another rate cut. The S&P 500 fell 5.5 points to 1390 yesterday, and the NASDAQ composite begins trading up 2 points yesterday at 2426. More on the economy in a moment. The father of LSD, chemist Albert Hofmann, died in Switzerland of a heart attack at the age of 102. Hofmann discovered the drug, looking for medicinal purposes, in 1938 while studying fungus.
Well, he lived a long life.
Ripe old age.
A ripe old age.
Longer than Jimi Hendrix.
Indeed. This is a radio show, though, we're going to talk about, which is going to make sure that you take part in the conversation. And with so much news today tied into the state of the economy, our question this morning is this: what's your backup plan to make ends meet when the economic downturn hits you?
How do you run the numbers? Do you have a plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D? We want to hear what your plan is. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I mean, I referred to selling your kidneys online. We're actually going to talk about that later. If you have a plan that's a plan F. But you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today there will be lots of economic news. The quarterly gross domestic product results come out indicating whether the economy is growing. Also, the Federal Reserve meets today. This follows gloomy news yesterday, John, of a 12.7 drop in home prices.
I think that's the largest on record.
And
it's never been bigger than that.
And that's not encouraging. And on top of that, foreclosures were up 112% from the same time last year. Today, though, some say the GDP numbers may not be as bad as expected. Is that right, Peter? Better numbers than expected?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the prognostications are sort of all over the board on what we're going to hear about the GDP in the first 3 months of the year. But a lot of economists think that inventories, stuff that they're making in factories, have been building up in larger quantities than we might have expected given the slowing economic conditions, and that alone was enough economic activity to keep things growing for the quarter.
That's Peter Goodman of the New York Times. He's joined us to help us sort through what's happening in the economy. Now, technically, the definition of a recession is two quarters of negative growth, but you say the country's on a knife's edge, while some people are arguing we're already in a recession and others not.
I'm not in the prognostication business. I mean, I can tell you what economists are saying. A lot of economists I've been talking to think that we're on the verge now of finding out what the next many months are going to be like, because either this big buildup of inventories is going to result in some extra sales. I mean, factories have been reluctant to let go of workers because, it costs money to let workers go. It's not good PR. It's not good for the workers. And they've been hanging on and hoping that orders materialize for the stuff that they've been producing. And if they don't get those orders, then they're going to find themselves with a lot of extra people, and then we're likely to see larger waves of layoffs, and then that takes us further down this spiral we're in.
And some of that hopefulness, of course, is tied to the stimulus checks that have started going out to Americans yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most people think we're going to get some bump up from these stimulus checks. People are going to take this money. They're going to go to the mall. They're going to go online. They're going to buy things. And that's going to lead to some economic activity. The question is that going to be enough to put some confidence back in markets so that banks say, wow, something really fundamental has changed here. The economy is on healthier footing. We're going to start lending money to people with, less than stellar credit. Businesses are going to say now might actually be a good time to expand, and they're going to hire more people.
Those are a lot of hopes there. Peter,
yeah,
when I look back at the economy, over the last month or so, it seems to me that there's an attempt by certain factors that are sort of market-based to kind of puff air into a balloon that seems to be slowly coming down, whether it's the manufacturing issues that you've talked about where, companies will try to sell inventories. There's also this enormous amount of money on the sidelines, this liquidity, whether we're talking about sovereign funds or rich people in the United States that keep trying to find things to invest in that produce these blips in the market. But if you're talking about a decline of real estate assets in the United States broadly, and the numbers yesterday were staggering, I mean, at some point, this balloon's got to settle.
That is one school of thought. It doesn't appear to be the school of thought that's driving actions at the Fed, where the hope is you make credit available, you flood the market with liquidity, and you hope the money goes places productive. And in particular, you hope you make it easier for people to get the next mortgage and put a bottom on a plummeting housing market.
Well, you have some experience in Asia. I mean, in the early 1990s, Japan had a recession that really was based in real estate assets, the bursting of a real estate bubble, and it went on for quite a long time. If that's what we're looking at here in the United States, and I'm not saying we are, but if that's the dynamic here, does that argue for this being more prolonged, more severe? What does it mean? It's kind of unprecedented in the United States.
Well, I mean, there's some pretty big differences between what we're going through and what Japan went through in its so-called lost decade. I mean, Japan had all sorts of political problems, and we could get there from here, but to date, there seems to be more of a will to try to reckon with the size of this problem for banks and move bad assets off balance sheets and make the financial sector healthy more quickly, as opposed to sort of trying to paper over the problem over years and years, as happened in Japan. But yeah, I mean, one similarity is that we're finding out that even if the Fed drops interest rates into negative territory in terms of inflation, where money's effectively free, banks still won't lend it if they're afraid that the overall economic conditions don't warrant it. I mean, if there aren't good businesses out there that can make money, banks don't want a piece of it.
Peter, a yes or no question very quickly. It's widely expected, right, that U.S. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will cut interest rates again today when the Fed Reserve meets?
That's the consensus. But the big question is, what sort of language are we going to get out of the Fed? Are they going to signal that they're worried that all of this cheap money is exacerbating inflation, and signal that, you know, this is it, guys, we'll give you one more round, but then maybe we even start lifting rates up long-term, or at least, you know, keep them level? Or is there more to come?
So we'll see. Peter Goodman, New York Times reporter. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. We're going to take a look at another sector of the economy right now. I mean, the decline in the Fed rate affects big banks. It affects the economy broadly, but it mostly affects big banks and their access to cash. But what about smaller banks? What about community banks? Joining us now is Robert Palmer, who's president and CEO of the Community Bankers Association of Ohio. Robert, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Good morning.
You know, I was reading yesterday that of the chartered banks in the United States, that's 8,640 or so, 8,300 or more are community banks. And I'm wondering how your access to capital has been affected by all of the big headlines we've been hearing about Bear Stearns and all of the larger banks here in New York.
Well, John, the community banking industry has traditionally been highly capitalized, well in excess of regulatory requirements, and there has been absolutely no impact as far as availability of capital for our banking industry.
But the Financial Times yesterday wrote a fairly draconian kind of scenario that suggested that with all of the concentration and access to the discount window that the big banks are getting, that the ability of community banks to respond to consumer woes, which is really their traditional expertise, has started to be a little more problematic. Can you explain if that's true or not?
Well, we haven't seen that happen in our industry. Many of our banks in Ohio and across the country continue to lend at record rates, both to consumer and to small business. We're seeing more apprehension on the part of the consumer to want to get in debt, which is traditional in an economic downturn. But as far as availability of money and the industry in general, that isn't happening.
What's your secret, and are you kind of a backstop to the economy here? That's pretty hopeful news if we've got a backstop.
Well, we would like to believe we're a backstop. As you indicated earlier, there's a tremendous number of community banks around the country as far as traditional banks are concerned, or commercial banks. And we've always been very steady, a mainstay in our communities, and we don't usually get caught in cyclical situations. We don't gamble on high-risk credits, and we are very conservative in our lending process.
You know, it sounds like advice that, you know, my dad gave me when I was leaving for college, Robert. You know, it's good advice for everyone. I guess the question really for the economy is, what ball do you keep your eye on to really gauge what the impact is for the consumer? And from the community bank perspective, it seems like things are doing pretty well.
Very well, John. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Robert Palmer is the president and CEO of the Community Bankers Association of Ohio. Well, that's some hopeful stuff.
That is, because it's so important. They're very consumer-based, right? So they're doing their best to help folks keep their homes and get money for other things.
Here's somebody else whose trend seems to be turning around. John from Brooklyn writes us in response to our takeaway response, "I just came out of 5 months of unemployment. My plan, if things get worse, I think 100 pounds of rice, a couple of cases of red beans he's going to buy, and he's headed off to Canada."
That's not such a bad plan, because rice is at a premium about now.
Well, don't take your dollars if you're going to Canada, man.
Right.
That's right. Our takeaway response, and we would love any kind of response, let's share these backup plans all together. So if the economic downturn hits us all, we can gather together and huddle together and figure a way out. What's your backup plan to make ends meet for when the economic downturn hits you? On the takeaway. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
Asking, what is responsibility in this day and age?
Everybody has their own opinion.
Thoughts shared at responsibilityproject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Stephen Devon, I'm working on a classified ad here. Can I try this out on you? For sale, adult left kidney, slightly used, best offer or willing to trade for brain of equal value. What do you think?
That's not bad.
Might get some action on that?
I prefer your right kidney, but I'll take the
right.
Left.
You prefer the right?
No.
With us is our friend, contributor, and author of Freakonomics, Stephen Dubner, who's going to talk about a very interesting idea for a backup plan to raise cash that you can actually carry out in Iran. There is an open market in Iran for the sale of organs, including kidneys. Can you describe that program? Yeah, like you can go to an auction and sell your kidney or your brain or whatever is available for transplant.
Well, yeah. So
this is an economic story, though.
It is an economic story. It's a healthcare story. It's a life and death story. You know, the fact remains that we who are alive now have lived through a medical miracle, which is that we can take an organ from one person who's either doesn't need it, which is rare, or dead, which is less rare, and put it in another person and save their lives.
We know that. The question is, in Iran, if you do that on the open market, how much can you get for it, and how do they work this kind of a program?
The government pays you a little bit, about $1,200 or so, but then
completely legal.
It's completely legal. There is a market. Now, the Iranian market is, A, not very transparent, meaning we don't know everything we would like to know about it for a variety of reasons.
Like how well it works,
We don't know. There are two big things we don't know that well. We don't know how well the patients do who receive the organs, and we don't know how well the patients do who give the organs. There's been a lot of medical literature kind of sputtering out of Iran for the last 10 years. This program started about 20 years ago, and it became legal to do so. Let me tell you,
but there's one really important consequence that I think you write about in your blog, and that is people don't typically die waiting for an organ in Iran.
They don't typically, they just don't.
Iran
has no waiting list for kidney transplants. The United States has a waiting list of about 80,000 people for waiting for a kidney transplant. Let me put it this way. In the years since Iran eliminated their waiting list, 30,000 people have died in the U.S. waiting for kidney transplants.
But do you think that information is reliable? If we don't know that much about the people who receive the organs or the people who give them, do we have any confidence that that's actually true? I think I read since 1999 they've had no one on their donors list in Iran. They cleared up this notion of people waiting or dying while waiting for a kidney.
That's what they say, and we are wise to greet with skepticism such claims. But I will also say this. News of this information and data typically travels within a community like the medical community or an academic community better than it does within the public sphere or even government information.
So there's just fabulous word of mouth traffic about Farooz down the road who has a kidney that's maybe
available. better than word of mouth. There are medical papers written by Iranian doctors. There's a very, very interesting and compelling paper, which is the reason that I wrote about this, written by a transplant nephrologist in North Carolina named Benjamin Hippen, who is kind of he's not a scholar by trade. He's a doctor by trade, but he's kind of an amateur scholar. And he's basically been keeping a file on Iran for 10 years or so, because there were papers coming out in medical journals here by Iranian doctors and so on. The more information he gathered, the more he thought, you know what, let me try to take a comprehensive look at how this market works. His conclusion is, while there are significant caveats, in other words, if you're going to build a market from scratch here for a kidney market, which is really what I'm talking about here, then let's look at Iran not as the perfect model, but as a model that has been in place, that has been put in place, and seems to work to accomplish the main goal, which is not letting people die of kidney failure.
Now, here in the United States, it is illegal, and many in discussions about it, one of the concerns, of course, is the ethics of this. who would be enticed to give a kidney, what the situation would be that would lead one. The American Medical Association's policy, though, seems a little confusing, at least to me, where they say the living donor should not receive payment for any of their solid organs. However, donors should be treated fairly. Reimbursement for travel, lodging, meals, lost wages, and medical care associated with the donation is ethically appropriate. That seems contradictory.
You know, I'm yes.
Palmanoff to location fees, right? Like they do in the movies.
Exactly. And, which leads to, I would argue that leads to the possibility of much more nefarious behavior, i.e. back deals.
Corruption.
So, you know, we wrote a piece in the Times a year or two ago about a woman who wanted to donate a kidney to a guy she found out about in an online organ donor forum. She wanted to do it initially because she needed the money. She assumed that she could be paid for it, and the guy who needed it said he would pay her. Then, when it was determined that it was illegal for any money to change hands, she, who really needed the money, her husband had lost his job, they had four kids, they live in very lower income circumstances in Connecticut. She said, you know what? I told the guy I'm going to give him a kidney. I'm going to go through with it. Now, the hospital, however, was very leery of her giving a kidney to someone who she didn't know, and they assumed money would change hands,
so
which meant that they had to lie about it then. They had to create
a
fake relationship. So what we're seeing is that people who need kidneys aren't getting them. People who might give them for remuneration aren't giving them, because you know what? We may be altruistic in our hearts, but it's what economists call impure altruism.
Impure altruism.
We want something for it, and most people are not going to give their kidney for nothing.
Well, forget kidneys for a moment. How does this market mechanism operate on maybe other difficult to distribute kinds of materials that, you know, we would like to get distributed more widely? We would like to solve these sorts of problems, and the market intervention, you know, could be a solution here. Where does this apply outside of kidneys?
Well, you know, look, if you look at other things from the body, you look at where now we give things and we sell things that we didn't used to sell: sperm, eggs, blood, etc. There are interesting permutations every time you put a dollar amount on it, though. For instance, if you ask people for blood, you get more if it's a voluntary donation than if you pay them. It turns out that paying people for blood...
True? That's interesting.
And part of that is because you got a lot of blood and it keeps coming, and you can give something, you can come back and give some the next day. If you give a kidney, you're not going to give another one the next day. Okay? Here's what I think is really interesting about it. If you let me backtrack for 1 minute. The reason that Iran did this... Do you want me to stop?
Yeah, actually, hold on for a second.
I'll stop.
We're going to get some headlines. We have more to talk with Stephen Dubner about. Kidneys, backup plans, what's your plan to raise cash in a difficult environment? But first, we have headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. In the news this morning, Kabul woke up to gunfire as Afghan security forces took on armed gunmen. And in Iraq, the trial of former Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz has been adjourned until May the 20th. An explosion has rocked Yemen's capital. The blast happened near the Italian embassy, and officials believe it was caused either by a hand grenade or a bomb. With America's Federal Reserve expected to cut rates today, Japan's central bank says it's leaving interest rates alone despite concerns about a global economic slowdown. And finally, the retiring Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern makes his swan song visit to Washington today to address a joint session of Congress and to have a final meeting with President Bush. And that's your news for now.
All right. And we want to remind you, if you have a plan to make ends meet, a backup plan in an economic downturn, tell us at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project,
featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day.
Stories to read, share, and respond to.
Available at responsibilityproject.com.
Because one responsible act
can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We are following today the story about the gross domestic product numbers, expecting those this morning. Also, the Federal Reserve meets today, and we are indeed following the presidential nomination contest. Let's take a listen to what some Indiana voters had to say about Barack Obama essentially denouncing his former pastor, Jeremiah Wright.
Sick of it. Why do they even continue to interview him?
He's not still a member of that church, so he evidently something changed.
You're worried about his influence over Barack Obama?
Yeah, and not only him, but over a lot of people that go to his church or that listen to him.
What do you think about Hillary Clinton?
If he wasn't running, she'd be my girl.
It kind of her attitude, not so much even her politics, is I just don't get a warm fuzzy from her.
Well, Senator Hillary Clinton has 6 days to win over that Indiana voter, as does Senator Obama. The important primary there is on Tuesday, and polls show the two contenders neck and neck. This go-around, those voters will have a big say in picking a Democratic nominee. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is road-tripping across the state, and she joins us now from Lafayette. Andrea, Obama's been facing tough questions this week. Yesterday, he said in strong words he was appalled by statements from his former pastor, Pastor Wright. They played all over the media. Are you hearing voter concerns about the issue?
Well, not so much among Democrats. Democrats seem to have, for the most part, made their peace with this issue. Although one woman, when I spoke to her after the press conference that Obama held yesterday denouncing rights, and she was an Obama supporter, seemed relieved to hear that more distance had been put between them. But I did meet some Republicans who were quite concerned. One woman referenced, she said, well, I'm not voting for one person because I know he hates America. So it does seem that if Obama does get the nomination, this is something that could potentially be an issue for him in the general election.
Well, it's certainly not something that the Barack Obama folks would like to hear. Now, tell us, what is the general mood? This is a state of roughly 6.3 million people. It's a rural-urban kind of mix. You were spending some time in Gary, Indiana, which is actually right next door to Illinois, and many consider essentially a suburb of Chicago.
Well, that's right. I've been in, and I'm still in, northwestern Indiana, which is right, in fact, for much of this area, they get the Chicago TV stations. But Gary is really, its own place. It seems like somebody just came into that town in the 1970s and stopped it. U.S. Steel was once a behemoth there. Now it's a shell of its former self. And if you drive down Broadway, south from the lake and south from U.S. Steel, you'll find facade after facade of shut down store. In fact, I was looking for a restaurant to talk to people, and I finally found one, Charlie's Coney Island Restaurant on Broadway, but almost everything in the town up to there was closed, and what people were really struggling. For the first time in this campaign, I had people say a big issue was food and getting enough to eat, and as a matter of fact, I think you have a clip of one gentleman that I talked to, Daryl Baker, who works as a contractor in the Gary area.
That's a big issue to me. $10 billion a month going over there, and you got people over here. And if you look around here, there's people out here that can't eat. And we spend sending $10 billion a month, and you know the $10 billion is not getting to Iraq. You know that, right?
Oh, man, I feel that's a bad personal lie.
You know, Andrew, I've spent some time in Gary. I mean, there's been prolonged economic distress in Gary, and now you see even greater distress focusing on food, as you mentioned there. What does that augur for these two candidates, Clinton and Obama? It's really kind of a puzzle to figure out which one they're likely to go with.
This is a big change for me, seeing people actually talking about food and an economy in such a raw way. And even when I went down a little further south, Valparaiso, which really is a bedroom community for Chicago. I mean, Gary is still sort of kind of its own place, but Valparaiso, people are commuting to Chicago 40 miles away. They're watching TV. But there were people there who were out of work. There were people there who told me they're using their tax rebates to pay for their prescriptions. So there is a sense of distress all the way through. And, you know, it's changed so much. When I started this race, everybody said Iraq, number one issue, global warming, big issue, and immigration. I'm hearing much, much less of that and much more of a economic talk. Now, this, obviously helped Hillary Clinton a lot in Pennsylvania. Will it help her in Indiana? I think it will help her among a certain constituency. I mean, there are large African-American areas of this state, and they, you know, like Gary, and they are with Obama staunchly. Although as
Gary, actually, Andrea, isn't Gary, doesn't it have the largest African-American population out of any city in the country?
It's, I believe it is 85%. African-American.
Percentage-wise, I should add.
So, yeah, I mean, I believe it is a very, very large African-American population, and I didn't meet anybody there who said they were voting for Hillary Clinton, although they did like her.
But the polls are tight, I mean, all over the state, and blacks are really a small minority in Indiana. I guess the question really is Indiana another one of these special case kinds of states, or does it give us any indication of what's going to happen in November?
Feels very much like a general election in this state, and I think it's going to be a very interesting question. The last-minute arguments that candidates are making. Hillary Clinton has an ad going after Obama on the economy right now. The Obama obviously is trying to get beyond this right crisis. He's helped by the fact that there's a lot of university areas in Indiana. Yesterday, I traveled almost from the old economy to the new economy. I ended up in Lafayette, Indiana, at the Bistro 501 restaurant, which was full of sort of knowledge economy workers, people from universities. Eli Lilly is big here. So there is a lot here, but it does seem to me that these candidates are going to really have to work on turning out their vote. And I'm imagining as I go further south and I meet more rural voters, there are going to be more Hillary Clinton voters. Up here, people know Obama.
Well, you're headed south.
You're going to be logging some miles.
That's right,
there
on Route
in Indiana.
65. Headed down Route 65, Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Time for some headlines. Femi, okay, what do you have?
We're just 2 hours away before we get the latest GDP figures. And in the morning, Robert Gates is defending the deployment of an aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf. In sports news now, in the NBA, defending champion the San Antonio Spurs advanced to the semifinals with a win over Phoenix. Meanwhile, New Orleans advances as well, knocking out Dallas. LeBron James and the Cavaliers try to advance as well tonight at home against Washington. And in baseball, Greg Maddux will have to wait at least one more start to try again for win number 350. As the Phillies spoiled his fun last night for the future Hall of Famer, Maddux failed for the third straight time in his quest. Now, we may be 100 days away from the beginning of the Olympics, but in the next 5 days, Ethiopia gets a rare chance to stage an international sporting event. Around 2,000 athletes will compete in the African Athletics Championships in Addis Ababa. This is the biggest sporting event that Ethiopia has ever hosted.
You trying to get us to send you there? Thank you.
I'd love to go. Thank you. Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Doesn't it feel good to share your financial backup plans? I always feel great when my wife and I run the numbers on what our plan B is. Here's one that we got from Don Taylor in Manhasset, New York. My alternative plan B is retire to Mexico, maybe take a factory job there, switch emphasis in my local private law practice to debt-related subject areas, pretty smart, bankruptcy, foreclosure, debt collection, and then three, go back and live with my parents. And he notes that he's 65 years old. Don, you've really thought this through.
Well, that's kind of, I find it kind of painful talking money, but here's an interesting one. Linda.
Are those consecutive, or are those one after the other? Or
I think that's
one after the other. One, two, three.
So one, I guess two, three. Maybe that's
consecutive,
the plan.
Like consecutive prison sentences. In other words, not, you know, they're not one or the other.
That's Stephen Dubner, the author of Freakonomics, who's joined us today. And we have one here from Linda from Whitestone, Queens. She says, I'm in the fitness industry, and interestingly, when the economy is on a downturn, the fitness industry takes an upturn. It seems that when so many people feel they cannot control oil prices, unemployment, government, or the planet, the one thing they can control is their bodies. My backup plan is to increase my business by continuing to advocate for people to pay attention to their health and fitness and help reduce stress levels that these times can induce.
Does that mean that people who are overweight believe they can control the planet?
I think she's mistaking correlation for I think what she's seeing is that a lot of people are out of work and they got nothing to do but go to the gym.
Well,
and
still,
also feel better.
Do you have a plan B? Do you have a plan D? Plan Z?
I'm thinking of cashing in on WNYC. Stock. Right.
Oh, stock. Right. Well, yeah. Yeah. Up with a bullet. Well, but you're an author. I mean, you had a fantastic, unbelievable bestseller. I mean, do you feel like your backup plan is the next book?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's not the backup plan. It's the only plan.
It's the only plan. So
it's there's important. No CD.
And if I weren't here at 6:40 in the morning, I would be typing on the next book, which is underway.
I thought.
Not to make you feel guilty.
In our household, I think I'm going to put my dogs to work. I got two Norwich Terriers.
You know what I think
figuring,
is a
figuring, they can at least
it's
pay
day
for themselves.
Three.
You know what I think is a great plan for dogs.
Day three, and we're talking about the dogs.
As a really bad golfer, I've always thought that a great way to make money with dogs is train them to be ball hunters. So if your dogs have a good sense of smell on a golf ball, you bring them out to the course, right?
Yeah.
But then what happens if they get beamed with one?
You got two.
Insurance for that. Let's set this.
Just like you got two kidneys, you only need
settle
one.
This. Let's settle this kidney thing before we go here. And we've got a couple other takeaway responses. Do you think it would be a good idea? Do you think this is going to catch on, this Iranian plan to have an open market for organs like kidneys?
In the U.S., there's a lot of resistance to an organ market for a lot of reasons. The biggest one is what we call repugnance. It doesn't seem to sit right with people. However, in the past, there's been repugnance at other things. Life insurance 200 years ago was considered a repugnant practice. You mean I'm going to cash in on a bet when my loved one dies? That's horrible. Obviously, we got over it. In Holland and in Israel, they're starting to offer some kind of compensation for kidney donors. Countries like that may lead the way for us a little bit more easily than Iran.
Less politically repugnant than Iran.
Exactly. And you also said, just very quickly, it's very interesting because medical advances are also creating new organs, so this whole discussion may be moot at some point way down the line.
Oh,
maybe
synthetic,
not in our
synthetic organs.
Maybe not
in
our lifetime, but at some point.
Synthetic organs are no longer sci-fi, and it's quite possible that this conversation we're having now is about a Band-Aid solution that thankfully won't be talking about anymore.
We are in the Matrix, Stephen Dubner. We are in the Matrix. Keep your takeaway suggestions coming. Plan B is for the economic downturn.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
A catalyst for examining the decisions that confront people
trying to do the right thing.
Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 30th, and we're following economic news today. We're expecting some GDP numbers to come out, giving us a sense of where the economy is. Also, the Federal Reserve is meeting, and we're taking a look at what's happening in the presidential nomination contest. And we're also going to look at some medical news that caught our eye. We decided to catch medical researchers in the act, as John likes to say, of well-discovering. A team investigating heart disease ran into a baffling medical puzzle. Why were African Americans failing to respond to beta blockers, a class of drugs that are widely used for heart disease? African Americans die from the disease at a 30% higher rate than whites, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So the team was a bit concerned and puzzled. Dr. Stephen Liggett, a professor of medicine at the University of Maryland, was among them. He's a pharmacogeneticist who says they found that 40% of their African-American patients actually make their own beta blockers. What does that mean, Dr. Liggett?
Well, the field is actually called pharmacogenetics, just so I can get that straight. And our basic premise is that there are genetic causes that result in differences in the response to medications between people. And the study that we're going to be talking about today, we did study congestive heart failure, which is a major public health problem. It affects about 5 million people in the United States, with about 25% of people actually dying within the first year. So we really felt that we needed to know the right drug for the right patients with no hit-or-miss approach or no one-drug-fits-all approach, which unfortunately is what has been happening a lot in these complex diseases. So we sequenced the DNA
of hundreds and ultimately thousands of people to look in the pathway that's involved with these drugs that you call the beta blockers to see if there were genetic variants that might help us understand who's responding and who's not.
And is this discovery, does this now mean that perhaps some of those people taking the beta blockers shouldn't be taking them since their own bodies are producing it? Or what path does this lead doctors down now knowing this?
Well, I think first of all, just in the way you explained it, it's a little bit of a complex series of thoughts that has to go through a physician's mind when he thinks about this particular variation, which is an improvement in function of a protein that has a tendency to block how the beta receptor works. So these sort of got some double negatives and things in there. And so at the get-go, there will be a process of education that will be required within the medical community to know about how this this variation works. Now, without having the test, though, and it's a genetic test, it's quick now. It doesn't require a lot of sequence. It can be done, in a day in a laboratory. Only a few laboratories, but it can be done. You can't guess whether you have it or not. You have to first have the test, and currently it's still under sort of a investigational umbrella. But I think there are a number of possibilities, including the one that you're referring to, and that would be that perhaps some patients do not need to take this particular medicine, which would be welcome to most, because most heart failure patients are taking 15 to 20 tablets a day.
Wow. Wow, that's a lot.
You've done some great investigation of the genetic basis of diseases like asthma. Is this a really broad new strategy for looking at a whole range of therapies targeted at specific groups based on their ethnicity, using genetics as a window?
Well, the only reason that this actually fell out to be more of a story for African Americans was that this particular variant occurred in 40% of African Americans and about 2-4% in Caucasian Americans. So, this only ended up that way because of where the variant was found. In our other studies with asthma, we have found genetic variants that cover the whole spectrum of different ethnic groups. So,
if you're not looking at the genetic variations, you're missing a whole sort of set of issues as far as public health is concerned. Stephen Leggett, thank you very much. It's a fascinating study and very, very interesting, especially as congestive heart failure is a serious problem for people with African-American descent.
Yes, and I think, just as a follow-up to what you said, which is exactly right, if we just use skin color, we would really not have much of a handle on what we're doing.
A good week for making that suggestion. Thank you very much, Dr. Leggett. Thanks. All right, the Olympics begin 100 days from today, and the Chinese Olympics appear to have an entire kind of cavalcade of potential problems associated with them, from the delays associated with the Olympic torch to worries about concerns of censorship by the Chinese government. The BBC's Daniel Griffith joins us from Beijing. We're 100 days away. What are the problems that the media is beginning to see that could develop between now and the opening of the Olympics on August 8th?
Well, you're right, John. We're 100 days away today, and I've been up at some celebrations outside the Olympic Stadium where all the major athletic events will take place in August, and very watching how the Chinese government is very keen to put a gloss on what's been happening over the past few weeks. But of course, the reality is that the events of the past few weeks have been completely overshadowing these preparations. And by that, I'm talking obviously about the anti-government protests in Tibet in March. Then we had those chaotic scenes around the Olympic torch relay that we saw both in Europe and in the US as well. And really, on top of that, concerns about, for example, issues like air pollution here in Beijing. The World Health Organization last year was raising concerns about the impact that air pollution evolution might have on both spectators and athletes here at the Olympics. And indeed, we've seen some high-profile athletes. I'm thinking particularly of the marathon runner Haile Gebrselassie, who has said he is not going to run in the marathon here in Beijing. He's going to run at a shorter distance because of concerns about that air pollution.
Well, we know you have to go, and so do we, but I want to ask one quick question. You know, there was a lot of concern about the Greeks not being able to pull the Olympics off this far out from the Games. What is the chance that a lot of this stuff is just going to go away and the Chinese will get their act together and these things won't be such a factor?
It's very difficult to see some of those problems going away. Certainly, the whole issue of Tibet is now really hanging over the Olympics. When it comes to air pollution, well, the authorities may manage to get a whole bunch of cars off the road, shut down some factories for the duration. They may manage to reduce air pollution, but the jury is still very much out on that one. However, there is one positive. When it comes to the infrastructure, John, they are pretty much on target. I was up at the stadium
today. They've got that
today.
One down.
They've nearly nailed that one. And don't forget, if there are any loose ends to be tied up on that one, they've got 1.3 billion people to throw at the problem. So at least when it comes to the infrastructure, that should be on target for when the Games start in August.
All right, Daniel Griffiths is in Beijing getting ready to cover the Olympics. 100 days, and we're counting down. Daniel Griffiths from the BBC, thank you very much. We've got more responses from people giving us their backup plans. Cynthia on our website says, we're not getting a penny from the president, but we started saving before this mess started. Now our only debt is our mortgage. As a result, we have money in the bank.
So, and we're getting some responses through Spinbox, our tool where you can leave a message, and sometimes we'll use your voice, and sometimes we'll read a transcribed version. And Tim from New Jersey says, what I plan to do is cut back on some of the extra things I've been doing over the years, going out to dinner, beer, entertainment. Love how beer is second.
Beer is an extra?
Beer, entertainment, because that is an area, he says, where disposable income probably goes the most. You still have to feed yourself. You still have to drive your car. You still have to put gas in it. Those things are a given. So if you're going to do anything, you have to cut back on some of the extra stuff that you've been doing over the years.
Well, I think that if you run the numbers, you know, a lot of people in America don't have a realistic idea of what they're spending. And so a lot of people talk about when they make a budget, when they actually do the numbers, they end up feeling better. And that's our idea. We want your response to what's your backup plan to make ends meet for when the economic downturn hits you. You can tell us at thetakeaway.org. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Okay, get it out.
Or call Spinvox at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. It's also got a lot of video on the site.
Yeah, we want
folks
to...
Are you there? Are you going to get there?
Am I going to get to...
Are we going to do a video of you?
No, we're not doing any
videos
of me.
Come on.
But what I do want to say is that if you go to the Takeaway, you see all our videos, our blogs, and our past segments. There's a video of John waking up at 3 a.m., and that's something, folks, you
got
to see.
I got my wake-up call, and I was ready on day one, which is more than we can say for Hillary and Barack Obama at this point.
And you'll find on our website we're going to continue covering all the economic news today. We have those gross domestic product numbers coming out. We have the Federal Reserve meeting this afternoon. Are they going to cut interest rates? And, of course, there's always new developments in the political universe.
We read every comment that you post. You can get in the mix at thetakeaway.org. And, you know, this is our conversation all together.
Absolutely.
This is The Takeaway. Your Takeaway.
877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.